Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, April 4th, 2011. I'm your humble host, PK, and I'll be here for the next hour. As always, I'm talking about issues that involve individual rights, liberty, property, and peace, sound money, travel, music, intellectual pursuits, good and bad humor, my take on current events, world events, and my cut to the chase solutions about many things. I hope to have a guest on tonight. We're going to talk about the gold standard, sound money, gold and silver. But in the meantime, America's sort of at war again. You know, I guess we're sort of at war. We're bombing people, but apparently there's not boots on the ground over there in Libya, where we get something like 1% of our oil. And so that turmoil's going on. And as I suspected, of course, the CIA's got its tentacles heavily involved over there. But on a humorous side, you know, the evil Gaddafi, he's fighting back. So I'm not so sure I'm totally opposed to him staying in power now because of the opposition who knows what they are. Are they Al-Qaeda? Are they people from the Taliban? Who knows what they are? Hodgepodge, ragtag bunch of rebels fighting against the evil Gaddafi, who gave up his nuclear program years ago and I guess renounced terrorism years ago. So he's kind of been playing ball with Uncle Sam and the feds and the CIA. All, I guess now he's fallen from grace, so they want to kick him out and put someone else in his place. And again, that's the problem with revolutions, because you don't know what you're going to get afterwards. You don't know what other puppet the CIA or the U.S., Britain, you know, NATO is going to put in their place, in this case, in our sphere of influence. You know, you don't know if it's going to be better or worse or about the same, like different leader, sort of same policies, but different leader couched in more, perhaps more charisma, this and that. For example, Bush and Obama, I contend they're pretty much the same. When you look at Bush and Obama side by side, of course, Obama's a more eloquent speaker, and he's the first black president, although I prefer to say mulatto or mixed race, because he got a white mama. So yes, he's got a darker complexion, but he's a lighter-skinned black. And also, lighter-skinned black folks, I didn't realize this or know this till a few years ago, but apparently there's a little friction between the lighter-skinned and darker-skinned black folks. It seems like the lighter-skinned black folks are often more in positions of power or up the economic totem pole a bit. So and Obama, of course, has that sort of complexion. But again, I'm very fond of quoting myself in this case. And Obama, once again, Obama may just as well be a mulatto or mixed race, blue blood, skull and bones member, because he's advocating basically the same stuff as Bush. He's a willful servant of the New World Order. And just like Bush, Obama serves Wall Street, the big banks, the military-industrial complex, and the Israeli lobby, especially AIPAC, which I have correctly renamed the American Israeli Parasites Against the Constitution. So let's take a look at Bush and Obama and where they're pretty much the same. In fact, have you ever seen that picture? It's a pretty cool picture. I've seen them on the web where they have pictures of Bush, maybe three photos of Bush and maybe four photos of Obama all in a row next to each other, and the photos turn into one. So you see Obama's haircut with Bush's face. I mean, it's pretty much perfect the way they did it. It just fits perfectly, and that's basically what we have. When we look at the two of them, we see that, of course, Bush is pro-war. Obama's pro-war. He's expanding the war without constitutional authority, because apparently Libya, with its massive military, has apparently threatened the United States. So now we've got to go bomb them. Okay, Obama's pro Gitmo. He hasn't closed it down. He said he would. It's just rhetoric. Did it to get elected? We know politicians lie to get elected, but Obama's got to be one of the most blatant promise makers or liars, however you choose to look at it. Okay, so we got Obama and Bush together. Pro-war, pro-Gitmo, pro-Patriot Act. And I understand the Patriot Act was being drawn up before 9/11 by that schmuck Michael Chertoff, who gets a rake or has thrived very well financially from these porno scanner machines in the airports. Another thing Bush and Obama have in common, the pro-torture, pro-rendition, that stuff's still going on. They swoop down, take a suspect from country A that doesn't allow torture, and they take him to another country like Egypt, or sadly enough, I think they were even doing it in Poland, or those central Asian so-called republics like Uzbekistan and those kind of places. They take these, swoop down, take these people, no trial. They take them there, and they sweat them, and they torture them, and they try to get information out of them. So, you know, Bush and Obama have that in common. And they also promote massive deficits, although Obama has spent even more than Bush. So, you know, to me, they're very similar. And I'm just waiting. Well, I think it's slowly starting to happen. Not as much as I would like to see. I would venture to say that maybe 10% of Black America is starting to wake up and see that Obama's the fraud and charlatan that he is. Smooth-talking lawyer. Obama is a smooth-talking lawyer who remains clueless about economics, economic policy, political economy. He talks a good game. He's smooth, charismatic. I like the way he clasps his hands together and has that serious look on his face, and he looks from left to right, and then he tells us what things are and how things will get better and how he inherited this mess, which he did, but he doesn't say how he made it worse. Just like FDR made the Depression worse. FDR made what Hoover did even worse. Hoover was, in effect, the founder of the New Deal. He was a big government Republican, big spending, public works projects. So he leaves office. Oh, and tax increases. So Hoover leaves office, and FDR gets in, and he expands government and spending and programs at a faster, larger pace. And, of course, he really screwed the American people when he signed the Emergency Monetary Credit Act, where they confiscated the people's gold. You had to go to safety deposit box. They'd take your gold. They would you had a bank personnel there, or I don't know, maybe law enforcement person, and they would go to your safety deposit box, and they would take your gold and then issue you a receipt for it. So that happened in 1933 when America went off the gold standard, which they followed. Britain went off in 1931. Equally bad. Before that, that fool Churchill, yeah, he brought Britain back on the gold standard after World War I, but he brought it at the pre-World War I price. So he had it valued at differently than it should have been, and he didn't take it at its realistic value. So then 2 years later, Uncle Sam does it by way of the wonderful Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or as I like to say, fascist dictator Roosevelt, or fascist Delano Roosevelt, or Franklin dictator Roosevelt. You choose the one you like the best, but you know, this guy, what he got away with. And now I wonder if that would have happened as easily today, and especially wars and the news of wars. Of course, I know wars are going on within the internet age, but with the internet age, we are much more informed about what's going on, because news travels in a split second, even faster than, say, in the 60s or 70s with just TV, because, yeah, TV would bring you to the other side of the world, but we didn't have like CNN then and whatnot. So now with you know, the internet, it just, you know, it just happens in a split second, which is why I like alternative radio and alternative internet programs like our wonderful host BBSradio.com, because they stand for free speech. And thank goodness we have this alternative way to get our message out, because the major media, CBS, NBC, ABC, NPR, Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, MSN, and pretty much all of neoconservative talk radio, you know, they sing the same song. They might disagree amongst themselves, but they pretty much go down the same path. And a good example of this is they pretty much both, especially during his campaign, they both relegated, I believe deliberately, obviously it was deliberate, they relegated Ron Paul to marginalize him as much as they could. So many people still haven't heard of the man. If they would have promoted him like these other useless candidates like Romney and Giuliani, Ron Paul's name would have been out there amongst the masses, and more people would have found out about him and heard about him. And he remains very consistent and right on the mark with his message that everything, pretty much everything that Ron Paul has written about, talked about, warned about for more than the last 30 years has come true because of his knowledge of economics, sound money, and the ethics of liberty. In fact, the only thing I probably disagree on Ron Paul with is abortion. And I'm not a militant abortion pro-choice person, but I just think it's a necessary evil that has to exist. And in my world, abortion would exist with absolutely no tax funding whatsoever, and there would be no late-term abortions. I'll become pro-life as soon as God and or nature stops with all the heartbreaking, heart-wrenching miscarriages. That's how I look at it. So that's my trade-off to God and or nature. Hey, it looks like my friend Whit is here. Whit, are you there?
Yes, I am, sir. How are you doing tonight?
Good. Welcome to Third Stream View with me, your host, PK.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you for allowing us into your schedule. Thank you for allowing us into your schedule. I know it's kind of late on your side of the country, but I certainly appreciate you coming aboard.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
Would you like some tea or coffee?
Yeah, I've had a little bit of things like that already, so I'm fine, thanks.
Oh, you had the green tea. Yes, okay. There you go.
Now, no, I had the
the green herbal tea.
Two of the black tea bags, Chinese black tea bags in one cup.
There you go.
It's cheap stuff and it's real weak, so if you use two tea bags, it's really nice tea, you know, and it's still really cheap, so.
Well, there you go.
Well, I just got into drinking tea about 2 years ago, you know, I was being a big coffee drinker for my life, and finally I got into tea, and I drink both now, and I love tea now, it's great.
I've never cared for coffee, but I do like tea. I usually have a spot of tea every morning, mate.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, I have invited you on so that I can consult your wisdom. You are a man who has his own gold-buying business. You are an honest man, and I know this because your logo says Honest Gold Buyer.
Yeah, right.
So therefore, you are an honest gold buyer.
It must be a pretty good name because a group copied it and they're franchising them.
Oh, well, they should. Well, I know that you are a man of integrity, and like myself, you are a man of wisdom of many things. Now, you certainly go past my knowledge about gold. I have a basic knowledge of it, and especially the definite, absolute importance of sound money.
Yes, there's no question about that. That's what we're all going to face right here in the next year, a horrific wave of inflation, unfortunately. It's going to be something that we'll all remember for the rest of our lives. It's going to be very dramatic.
I see it coming. I go shopping and I see the petrol prices for you Americans. That means gasoline, and I'm seeing the prices in the grocery stores creeping up. Before we start, Whit, I just want to bring something to your attention that you probably already know about, because I think I sent you an email earlier, and I want all of America to know what a tragedy is, what is happening to this 67-year-old American named Bernard von Nothaus.
Yeah, that's really disgusting.
This gentleman has been convicted of, what, counterfeiting? Because he...
He's issued currency that was not legal tender.
Yes, but it was...
That's what he's convicted of.
Yeah, that's the Fed's case. It's not counterfeiting per se, because he issued a real currency of with gold and or silver coins. Is it silver or is it gold?
By counterfeiting, you'd be trying to imitate the currency that's in existence. He's replacing it with an honest currency that actually has its own intrinsic value as opposed to a notional value.
Was it gold or was it silver he was minting?
So it was 1 ounce silver coins, a Liberty coin, you call it, or something like that. Liberty ounces, right, or something.
Now let me tie something into this, because you'll absolutely agree. Now, if you or I had been on that jury, we would have acquitted him because we believe in fully informed juries, not just because we would say, oh, he's not guilty. We know the principles and the philosophy involved. So if everybody learned about fully informed juries from grade school through high school through college, we wouldn't be in a lot of this mess, would we?
Well, there would certainly be a more active group of people trying to get rid of bad law, which is what jury nullification is all about, which comes from us originally, as far as I know, through the English, but originally from the Dutch. In fact, trial by jury was gotten by the English from the Dutch. The Dutch gave us all kind of stuff, stock markets, short selling, insurance, all this stuff. And the British copied it. They fought a naval war that lasted 20 years or something with the Dutch, and they finally managed to beat them, because their ships were so much better. They got the shipbuilding technology. They got all these cultural things from the Dutch. And then in the last decade, the Dutch king came over and became king, and that was William and Mary.
William of Orange
actually took over the kingship of England. So there was this huge cross-current cultural thing between Holland and England, and much of the stuff we get that we treasure from the British came from the Dutch. I'm not Dutch or anything. It's just an interesting historical thing.
No, I enjoy that. I've always admired the Dutch. I've been to Holland a couple times. I love Amsterdam, and I respect the people. And
businessmen.
Yes,
and it's businessmen and traders. You know, they really love to trade, and the ship that I don't know if any of you saw Master or Commander, the classic British sailing ship that they had in their navy.
I love that movie.
That from the Dutch. That's what they conquered the whole world with, was this Dutch sailing technology.
Well, speaking of the Dutch, I'm ashamed of the way Uncle Sam and or BP treated them last spring, because they offered to send their people over immediately because they got some advanced oil reclamation technology, but it wasn't good enough for Uncle Sam and the unions. I don't know if you knew about that.
That was a terrible disaster and everything, but I think in the end it was a little bit overwrought.
It certainly was.
I don't want to sound like a heretic or anything, but...
No.
You know, the truth of the matter is, the brutal truth of the matter is the fact that crude oil is a natural product. You know, it's product of the earth,
right?
And there's areas in the ocean where it comes up naturally all the time, and always will for a long time. And the fish, the microorganisms love it, so they thrive when they get around this stuff. They gobble it up like it's really, really tasty. So the microorganisms get into the multicellular organisms, and the next year they're into the little fish. And then, so folks, the fishing in the Gulf in like 4 years is going to be unbelievable.
I'm sure.
Unbelievable, because when that micrologic, biologic life gets up to that level, it is going to be something to see. We'll see if I'm right or wrong, but that's what happened off of Southwest Florida after Andrew came out of the other side of the peninsula in the Everglades and stirred up all the microbiological biologic life and shoved it out into the Gulf, and then 3 years later it was like the best sport fishing place in the whole world.
Wow. Well, you know,
got up the food chain of the large fish.
Back to Holland, the Feds screwed the Dutch again, the federal government, in 1989 with the Exxon Valdez. Holland sent people over to help right away, and they were turned back. So...
I just wanted to go off next to
the Dutch background in banking. But so you are an investor. You buy and go and sell gold.
Yes, we're a gold liquidator coins, platinum, gold, silver jewelry, silverware, predominantly gold jewelry, silverware, and coins, silver and gold coins.
Where do you see
the
gold
to the general public, though? We don't sell coins to the general public, but we do buy.
We're really, truly
an honest gold buyer. You know.
Where do you see the gold price going?
I'm very bullish on both the metals. I think they're going to go a lot farther. They've gone so far so quickly that right now, I mean, I 2 weeks ago I would have said, you know, the sky is falling, but right now they just look so darn strong. I mean, the gold-silver ratio is falling, and if you're into metals, you really need to learn about the gold-silver ratio, which is a simple thing. You just take the price of an ounce of gold on the COMEX, which is on the Internet all over the place, and you divide that by the price of silver on the COMEX. So right now I think it's about 47 or 48, and that's really, really low by historical standards. And the lower it goes, the more bullish. It's a very, very bullish indicator for the price of metals. So when gold was in the doldrums, gold and silver were in the doldrums in 02 and 03, the price of the gold-silver ratio was like 100.
Uh-huh.
Right? So now you get back to this, and at this point it's 47. So clearly the thing you want to have been in those two times is not gold, but silver, because silver has gained as a percentage of purchasing power and wealth much more than gold has.
Right.
And I think so that's going to continue.
Are they equally valid to back money with, to back currency with?
Yeah, it was actually a tri-metal system, because they had copper was the small incidental change. They also used something else. I can't remember what it was. Copper and nickel. Yeah. Copper and nickel. But people say, you know, what's special about gold? You can't eat it, da-da-da-da-da. Well, the reason that gold is the best money, and silver too, for the very same reasons, is that silver slightly less just because it's not as portable and convenient as gold, because you can carry a lot of wealth in just a small amount of area. But gold, you know, it's precious. People like the look of it. It has a certain luster that nothing else has. People desire it. Because it's the greatest true preserver of wealth there is. You know, if you want to trade, if you have boards and you want to trade for cows, but the guy doesn't need boards, you can do that with money.
Of course.
You know what I mean? So money is very important, and you want money to be stable and not going up and down in value. You want it to be stable because people can make accurate decisions about the future. And that's why gold and silver money are so important. And the other reason, the really fundamental reason why gold is so valuable, is at the present time you have to move 1 ton of gold ore and refine it with the acid and all that equipment they use to grind it down and acid bath and cook it and all this stuff to get the gold out of it. You got to move 1 ton to get 3 grams.
Wow.
Gold. 3 grams of gold. That's the average gold in the mines today. You're getting 3 grams per ton. Back in the 50s, it was considered to be really hard times when they had 15 grams per ton. So it's hard to get. You know,
what about silver? Is silver hard to get, too?
The reason it's valuable is because it's hard to get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, is silver equally hard to get?
Silver's... You hear different numbers, but it's 8 to 12 times more common than gold in the crust of the earth.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Much of the silver comes from gold mines.
Here's how I look at when I explain gold and silver. Of course, gold has like a 6,000 year history.
I guess I don't think that much, but you know, near 5,000. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And gold. And I would assume silver, they have some of the same characteristics, I would think. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes,
but
they do.
They are acceptable worldwide. They are divisible, and they're storable.
Mm-hmm. That's right, storable, divisible. And not only that, but here's the thing, folks. When you have gold and silver money, the money itself has its own value. So it's independent of the government's actions.
Correct.
They can't dilute it. They can't create it and have it, and you don't have it, and they do. I mean, you know, we have a system of legalized counterfeiting throughout the world, not just the United States.
Oh, I know.
The United States gave the model to everyone of this legalized counterfeiting. The only reason they don't throw them in the jail for making all this money is because it's legal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
legalized
as simple as that. It's, you know, they control the law, and they're forcing this ever-increasingly worthless money upon us all. It's a disaster.
Now, if we had a real gold and silver standard, you know, an honest money, we'd still have paper money, right? But it would be absolutely backed by gold and silver. Is that correct?
Well, there's lots of ways to do that, but that would be the most practical one at this point in our lives and at this point in our civilization, because money's been so unbelievably loose and notional. You know, it's a notional thing. Forget about gold and silver. Let's talk about paper money. Just to make a comparison. The dollar has a value, right? You can get so many yen for it or so many, and this is all moving up and down every day. All these different currencies are moving around against one another. And all these other currencies are all paper-backed. They don't have any gold or silver backing. So you think about this thing that we all try to get is money, so we can, you know, buy stuff and provide for our standard of living. There's nothing wrong with that, you know.
Correct.
But we're trying to get this thing because our government has assigned this unit to us, whereas it was gold and silver, it had its own inherent value. But the point I'm really trying to make is this. Like, you know, there's no metrics to it. In other words, if in a foot there's 12 inches, in a meter there's 1,000 millimeters.
Okay.
When it's 97 degrees outside, it's 1 degree less than when it's 98. I wear a size 12 shoe. You know, my motor in my truck has 2.7 liters in it. You know, all these measurements, everything's measured. The asphalt out on the road, it has to have a particular percentage of petroleum in it, or it's not legally asphalt. So in a court of law, they take them to court of law, they say, well, you don't have petroleum, and they can make them tear the whole thing up and do it again.
Wow.
Because you have to be able to prove things with numbers. Everything is quantified, right? Everything's quantified.
True. How can it be any other way?
Our money is not. Our money is determined by rumor, innuendo, rampant speculation. You know, this forex market and the paper money is a currency, is a commodity. The monies are a commodity. So it's determined by this most ridiculous of systems. And it's constantly going up and down. It doesn't have a determined value. So the one thing in our whole lives that we must have is a metrics to our money. And we don't. And that's a cruel, cruel trick the government plays on you when they do that.
That's interesting, because
they can create it out
of
nothing. Now, I just want to ask anybody on our radio audience, you know, is there anybody who doesn't want to have one of the employment applications for the guy who creates the money? I know I want to apply for that job. Do we even know how they're chosen?
Oh, are you talking about Fed governors?
The Federal Reserve. We don't know anything about how it really works. And so it's this huge smoke and mirrors game, in my opinion.
How about what they've just had to publish lately?
Yeah,
they just purposely lending money to all these foreign banks and businesses?
And then the smoke hasn't cleared in the room, because the night it was released, Ron Paul said that he thought that there was about $100 trillion. And
wow.
I've seen nothing of that from Paul or anybody else since then. If it was a slip of the tongue, it was a slip of the tongue, but it's not. And they're trying to figure out how they're going to tell everybody this. That's 2.5 years planetary GDP, folks.
Wow.
That's every shoestring, every house, every car, every real estate deal, every hour worked by everybody on the planet, everybody, all of it, every prostitution trick, every drug deal, everything, the entire global GDP for all the countries and all the humans on the planet for 2.5 years. I personally think that that's shocking.
Wow.
And here's the real laugher. Here's the real laugher, Fred. They said they paid it back with interest. It's okay. They paid it all back with interest. There's not near enough money in the world to even begin to do that.
Well, can't they just print it? Can't they print the interest?
No, you're talking about massive sums of money here. This is much, much more than was ever spent in the history of the world before that. Cumulatively. Wow. Yeah. And they didn't tell us. But then if the 100 trillion rigger is wrong and he meant 100 billion, then that's a different thing. But, I mean, I hate to bring up a spurious fact because it could be wrong, but it's pretty interesting. The whole thing is really shocking.
PK wants to know here, what is your scenario for when the economic collapse comes, which could easily happen within the next couple of years, where the dollar completely crashes? Now, you already hold gold. What is going to happen? What do you see happening to the economy? I mean, do you see a civil war between the haves and the have-nots? Or what is your – like your? I'm interested in your opinion of the worst-case scenario when the collapse hits.
Well, I think worst case scenario is not the. I think if you don't mind, I think most probable scenario is what we should really talk about. Worst case scenario, God, you know, I mean,
most probable
could really, really be bad.
Most probable.
Most probable scenario. That's a very, very difficult one too, because there's so many variables. I'm certain that we're going to have a really serious bout of inflation, and. You know, the thing everybody needs to remember is when the inflation really starts to get rolling, it's going to be ever increasing. It's a like a logarithmic curve up, because in order for them to get the juice out of the new money, they have to produce more money than they produced the last time. So their escalator runs faster and faster when they do it. Because you see, this is the thing that your audience really needs to listen, because many of them know it already, but this is a very important point. We've all been lied to when they taught us what inflation was. We've all been taught that inflation is an increase in prices. That's technically price inflation. What inflation really is an increase in the supply of money.
Of course.
That's what causes the prices to go up.
Right.
An increase in the supply of money. So inflation is an increase in price of money. Price inflation is the price increases. So, you know, they're not talking about the right thing. They're talking about the prices. We all know the prices are going up. They don't talk about the fact that it's an increase in money. Why? Because they're the one producing the money.
Well, it's part of their smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. Well, that's,
we saw what happened to
really
Zimbabwe.
And that's their only thing they have. That's the only real power they have, is the production of the money. They could control the interest rates, but that's all over with, because they've got them down at 0.25%. But it's a mess. I mean, we're going towards some really serious times. We'll all remember them. It's going to be like what you might have heard of Germany after the First World War, or many of these South American, Central American countries.
Right.
It happened to Russia when they collapsed, when the Soviet Union collapsed. They went through a horrible inflation. And the old people who on the fixed incomes were, I don't want to scare your listeners, but I mean,
if
they don't have anybody to take care of them, it gets seriously, seriously bad very quickly.
I'm worried about food production. Food production.
Yeah. Well, start a garden. It's important to start a garden because the first time you do it, you'll probably screw up something and you won't get much out of it. It's going to cost you a lot of money, and then you'll have the garden. You won't have to put much money in it the second season, and you'll be you know, getting on the learning curve and doing it.
Well,
because
and
it's
people
an
better,
important life skill to know how to raise simple vegetables in a
people better be able to defend that garden too, because that's going to happen too. Roving bands of hungry people.
Well, talk to your neighbors. You know.
Yeah.
Talk to your neighbors about that. You know, because that's who's going to, you know, in I don't know about most probable, but certainly possible situations would be that the neighborhood has to defend themselves, because the police are going to be overwhelmed.
Well, I've been stockpiling food myself, mm-hmm. because also not just for consumption, but, you know, a can of soup could buy you gasoline or things that you need, or clothing.
Absolutely. And that raises another important point about the whole thing is what you'll find is when inflation gets up to 25%, 20%, 30%, 35%, then people start to realize that, oh, man, I don't want to hold these dollars, you know. I really don't want to hold these dollars. I want to buy something, even if I don't need it. I know Mel's going to need it next week. I'll sell it to him.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? You see what I mean?
Right. Well,
so, and then you get up into where it's really, really seriously high inflation, and people are maniacal about getting rid of the money. So what that does is, And the tipping point seems to be about 25 or 30%, according to this Gonzalo Lira guy who lived through the Chilean inflation under Allende before Pinochet took over.
Right.
At 20 to 30%, it becomes a tipping point where what happens is the government really doesn't have to produce much more money. People realize that they want to get out of money. You see what I mean? So it's
right.
a self-fulfilling prophecy that the value of the money goes down because people don't want to get rid of it so quickly. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Wow. You know, so the actual, the people, it's called a flight from money, and that's when the really bad part of the inflation happens. That's when the really scary part where people don't, you know. I mean, think of how terrifying it is, and I'm not trying to scare your listeners again, but you read about Germany and these other countries. What happens when you can't effectively buy and sell things? You know,
barter.
That's a pretty scary thought. You know, that's a pretty scary thought. So, yes, store food, absolutely. You want to store food because if you don't eat it, you can always sell it. You can always give it to charity. There's going to be an unlimited amount of charity to fulfill. But, you know, it's just, it gives you the self-assurance for when the first big run on the supermarket happens and it's these long lines around the supermarket that pick clean, you got some stuff at home already. So I recommend to all your listeners, if they haven't done it, taking precautions already, to every time you go to the grocery store, buy 15% extra, spend a little more money in canned goods, rice, beans. Put it
wow.
away.
I
can't go wrong. You absolutely can't go wrong with that.
I agree. Listen,
well,
I got
there's two reasons, and I don't want to interrupt you, but you're getting your money out of dollars, Fred.
Right.
See, you want to get out your you want to get your wealth out of dollars as much as you can because the dollar is going to collapse very quickly at some point.
Wait, PK has a. I have a little email note here from Andy. If he's out there, feel free to call in and ask Whit a question if you like. But here's what Andy wrote to me just now. He said, silver is quite often a byproduct of gold and other metals production. It is rare to have just a silver mine.
Yeah, only about 20% of the silver is taken out of silver mines. He's actually right about that. I didn't want to get into that, but it's a very interesting part about silver is that it has a kind of a reverse relationship with boom. It's odd because when times are booming, you know, silver is generally lower. And there's a lot of it coming out of the ground because you got your copper, zinc, tin, lead, and gold mining's, you know, going pretty strong, at least not necessarily gold, but all the other ones, particularly copper and tin, you know, those other ones. Copper is a big supplier of silver. Well, the copper mining is way down, you know, because the housing boom's over and all these other things are way down. So that silver's not coming out of the ground.
Oh.
So supply goes down in a boom. Isn't that weird?
Wow.
So, because only 20% of the mines are real true silver mines.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the gold mining goes up, so that helps the silver production a little bit, but the big ones, because you know, in copper and lead and tin, they move huge amounts of earth, so they find the silver there, and it's a nice byproduct that they can profit from.
Now, I have an old American Opinion magazine, which is the John Bircher thing from 1980. Do you recall when the Hunt brothers were buying up all that silver?
Oh yeah.
Now, and back then is. As I understand it, they weren't buying it to corner the market, per se. They were buying long, and the government screwed them because then they changed the rules of the game, and those who were buying short benefited. But I think Nelson Bunker Hunt, I think it was him who said at the time, any fool can run a printing press.
Right.
And I think that they were. I think that they wanted to issue a sound silver-backed currency. Do you know much about that episode in American monetary history?
No, there's lots of stories. I know quite a bit about it. The Hunts were railroaded.
Right.
And there was a thing called, I can't remember what it was actually called, the Silver Traders Adjudication Board or something like that. This is where in the silver market they judged if there was a trader that was doing something wrong. And they drugged the Hunts in there because they owned 8% of the world's silver supply, and which is chicken feed, really. I mean, it sounds like a lot. You can move markets, certainly, but... By the way, the Hunts weren't in physical near as much as they were in futures positions. So they were really buying paper silver, a lot of it. So that's a real misnomer right there. They did have a huge physical position, but they were mostly banking on it going out. And what was happening was the shorts, because silver has been, you know, pillaged for decades, large interests have wanted to short the price of silver for various reasons, but principally because the large users benefited because this stuff was cheap. So, you know, Dow Chemical, Eastern Kodak, I can't mention names on the radio, that wouldn't be a good thing for me to do, but large economic interests around the world didn't want to pay a lot of money for the silver. Uh-huh. And I can go into that one night because it's a long story, but it's very interesting. But I won't just say there were a lot of silver shorts and they were very powerful. Right. And guess who was on the board? Guess who was on the board that ruled against the Hunts?
I'm sure it won't surprise me. Who?
The judges were the short seller buyers themselves, the short sellers themselves. I'm not making this up. The very people who were taking a loss from the Hunts were the very people who railroaded him.
Right, right.
Legally railroaded him.
Were they also bureaucrats?
No, they were, traders, guys who worked for large people, large industrial concerns that needed silver,
Oh, okay.
In those days, it was still manufacturers were huge silver consumers. Because we didn't have digital in those days. We still had film.
Until recently, silver's only been, last couple of years ago, silver was like, wasn't it still around $5 an ounce?
No. I mean, it was $7 an ounce in 05.
That's still cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, it's almost 38 now.
That still seems kind of cheap to me. I wanted to mention this to you, Whit, that about 2 or 3 years ago, at the peak of Zimbabwe's disaster from this idiot Mugabe.
Robert Mugabe.
On YouTube, I saw poor black Zimbabweans. It showed them every day they would go out and they would mine for gold and they would get specks of gold.
That's a really sad thing.
But here's what they were doing. They would have specks of gold or kernels of gold and they would take it to outside of their villages or whatever to buy food, to buy toiletries, to buy the things they need. That's all.
Bag of flour.
That's all that the suppliers would take. But these poor black folks, it showed them, they were mining gold, and they would bring just little kernels or specks of gold, and that's what they used to purchase.
Little pieces of paper and wrap them up. I saw that.
Yeah, so, I mean, as tragic as that was, it's a message like, hello, even the other black folks who were selling them food or whatever they needed, they would only take gold.
Best investment, in my opinion, is junk silver coins. Pre-1965 quarters, dimes, and half dollars. There's no numismatic value. There's no rarity there. Forget about that. It's the silver content. That's the cheapest way into silver. Don't get bars. The coins are readily identifiable. They're going to be easy to sell because everybody knows what they are. And you get a 10 or 20 ounce silver bar, and you want a loaf of bread, well, you're overpaying,
Right, yeah. Well, I had a couple
interesting thing is a guy named Bill Botter, who writes the Daily Reckoning, he tells about was the fact that from the time of Rome until, 1880, throughout the world, an unskilled laborer's day's wage was essentially just slightly fractionally less than one of those mercury dimes that are made of silver.
Wow.
That was a day's wage for an unskilled laborer, like a ditch digger. Now, that went from the time of Rome all the way in the 1880s because the Comstock Road came out and just, everybody was walking their hips up to the hips in silver. It was so much silver coming out of the ground in Nevada, it collapsed the price of silver. From the world for so much, it was a huge inflation. So you can actually have inflations with gold and silver. They're rare, but you can actually have them. They strike a big strike, but all those big strikes, pretty much finished. It's thought.
Wow.
It's an interesting thing because they discovered this in southern or central Nevada, but as Comstock lived in Nevada, they started digging there in the 70s, I think, maybe late 60s and early 1870s, and they just, it was a vast, vast, vast amount of silver. And then stuff started to come out of the ground, and the Americans made it into coins and spent it. Took it over to Europe, took it over to Asia, and rich guys go around flaunting their money, spending all this money. So this silver hits the streets in Europe and Asia. Well, now, remember, Germany is only a country after 1871. Germany never existed before 1871. So they got this powerhouse getting started here, and they didn't have any gold mines, so they had a silver-backed economy. And the same thing with China. They didn't have a lot of gold. They used silver.
Right.
And so when this inflation happened, it wiped out the economies of Germany and China. It wiped them out. Famine, the whole thing, you know. It was really bad.
It's interesting you mentioned those two.
You can actually have inflation with hard money, but it just doesn't happen very often.
It's interesting you mentioned Germany and China, because I saw a show a few weeks ago. I forget what it was, but it was talking about how as the U.S. becomes like a second-rate competitor, whatever, it said Germany is going to be poised to be a big competitor for China.
Not if they bail out all the European Union, they're not.
If they what?
Not if they bail out the whole EU for all their real estate debt, they're not.
Let's hope not. Hey, I want to ask you, I've got a couple older silver dollars from like the 20s or whatever. And how did that work back then? Did the government mint the coins? How did that gold or silver work back then when we had more
of
us?
The Treasury minted the coins.
And then they circulated it to the people? Or how did it get
right,
into people's
hands? Most of it was held, the gold was held in banks and was issued as paper on that. And you could go to the bank and you could they'd give you the gold. If you wanted it in gold, what's it called, specie. If you wanted specie, they had to give it to you.
Uh-huh. And that kept it in check.
But paper, if you have trust in it, the paper works better because it's just so much easier to use.
Right.
And, you know, there's also the problem with coin shaving.
Right.
You know, they'll shave a little bit off the coin. It's not a perfect system, you know. It's not a perfect system, but, you know, we could have some modern thing around the coin or something, I guess. You could prove that it hadn't been shaven.
Ludwig von Mises said that, you know, the gold standard is not the perfect system, but it's the best we could have.
Right. You want stability. You know, you want stability in your money. Because it's an endless temptation for the people who issue it just to keep issuing more of it, you know, greater or lesser amounts. And they have no right to do this.
Well, you know, some people say, oh, we'll never get rid of the Fed. You know, well, you know, I remind them that, you know, Jefferson got rid of the first bank of the U.S., Jackson got rid of the second bank of the U.S. It would seem like, you know, perhaps the Fed's days are numbered, or it could happen in our lifetime.
We can get rid of the third bank.
Right.
Because this is the third bank. Yeah. We're never going to be able to go forward as a nation until the Federal Reserve is either totally emasculated and just kept in as window dressing or abolished.
This quantitative
easing. Here's the thing to remember. One thing a lot of people don't – I'm sorry to cut you off. What were we going to say?
Go ahead. This quantitative easing is scary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But that's nothing compared to $100 trillion. That's scary. Because that $100 trillion, folks, if that's true, what does that mean? He could have misspoken, but let's just get into the situation that Ron Paul is at least approximately accurate. And that in all the documentation that nobody's managed to read all of, because there's 27,000 pages and it's really dense stuff, that it is revealed that they issued $100 trillion. What are the Japanese bondholders who hold American Treasury bonds going to do? What are the Chinese who hold huge amounts of our treasuries and dollars? What are they going to do if they realize that 2.5 years of planetary GDP of these dollars actually was created?
Maybe they would do what Germany did in the 20s. People literally burnt the money to keep warm.
Right.
They literally burnt the paper marks to keep warm.
I'm talking about these. You know, the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. You know, it's what the people used to trade with.
Right.
And it's by far the most numerous currency. But there are these large holders of this dollars abroad. Governments, and when it's realized that there's so many more of them out there, I mean, they're not idiots. They've realized that they've got to cash these in before everybody else gets to the window and tries to cash them in first.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if this is real, this is going to be, this whole hyperinflation thing could happen 1 hell of a lot faster and one hell of a lot sooner than we thought.
You know, I have a banker friend. Well, of course, you are familiar, of course, with the Austrian theory of the trade cycle. You understand that.
I'm a believer.
That's right, me too.
The truth.
Now, here's
the best model ever come up with.
Here's something that's kind of sad, but funny, but sad at the same time. I have a good friend who's a banker. He's got a real fat gig. He's making $200K easily a year. He thinks it's nonsensical. He thinks it was that the boom and bust, this mess we're in, was caused by greedy Americans and a lack of regulation.
I said to him, that's just horrible. I said, what?
So are you telling me that greedy Americans lowered the interest rates and started, you know, are they the ones that lowered the interest rates? And he kind of like shrugged it off, but he's actually hostile.
The Fed created the money.
Oh, of course.
The Fed created the money. If the Fed had not created the money, there would have been no housing boom. End of story.
And the masses,
are directly responsible for the entire thing. All the mortgage subterfuge, that's different. All the, you know, cheating the little old ladies, all the selling things twice, all the BS about, you know, Alt A and, you know, subprime and all the jumbo, all that stuff. None of that would have happened. The entire boom would have never existed unless they had, Alan Greenspan had lowered interest rates down to 1% and opened the spigot and created all this money. It's as simple as that.
Well, I like to say is that the masses, they blame the bankers, but that's just the symptom. The source is the Fed, and the Fed made it easier for those bankers to manipulate things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Fed is the central bank. They're the ones who, but let's say you bought a car in 06, and you went into the bank, the little savings amount, or the little credit union, or your local bank, whatever, not a big one, just a little one, or even a big one, it doesn't matter. You apply for the loan, and you sit there nervously, are they going to give me the $20,000 or the $10,000 for the car, or whatever it is, you know, and then they said, well, you know, you've had problems in the past, but we think you're a good risk, and they gave you the loan. Well, what they had done there is they contacted the Fed and asked for the approval, and then the Fed issued them the funds.
Uh-huh.
That's how the money was put into the system, is by the issuing of debt in the form of loans.
The
money was not created on a printing press. That's a misnomer.
It was
the money
credit
was
expansion.
Issued largely in the form of loans and treasury bonds.
Right, as the Austrians say, it was a credit expansion that caused this.
A credit expansion, right, which causes a distortion of the pricing component, and it leads to malinvestment. It makes people think that houses are going to go forever, so they invest in houses, which was a very, very bad thing to do.
But you still hear, but the masses, again, the masses, when they, their anger is directed at the bankers, they hardly ever blame the Fed. They're only seeing
the
bankers.
But the Fed are bankers. They are the central bank.
Yes, I know what you're saying, but regular folks, they don't know the trades, they don't know the Austrian theory of the trade cycle, so they, you know, they conveniently blame the bankers. And yes, a lot of them were fraudulent, but they were given this heroin by the central bank.
Right.
You know,
and then they exacerbated the whole thing instead of doing the normal thing of keeping the loans, and the person pays the loan back, and in 30 years they get their money back. Oh, no. No. That wasn't enough for the people to package the mortgages. No. They had to sell the loans off. And so they got money from both ends. So they sold these loans off as bonds or, you know, mortgage-backed securities.
Were those the derivatives?
And they were going to get the profit from this. And, so as a result, you get things like the banks don't know who they owe the money to.
Was that what the derivatives were?
The derivatives were the mathematical tool, essentially, that they used to come up with the rationalization for insuring the debt or the risk, or the insuring the risk of doing this.
Wow.
So there's $1,500 trillion worldwide of derivative debt. It's like 35 years planetary GDP.
I appreciate
never
your...
Be paid. It's not worth anything.
Well, on behalf of myself, PK, I would like to thank you again for coming on. I got to wind this down.
Sure. And, all right. I appreciate the opportunity. We'll do it again sometime.
But listen, hang on. Don't worry about spreading any doom and gloom, because this show is not going to blow sunshine up America's butt. We're telling it like it is here, and people got to realize.
Right.
They've got to make allowances. They got to be ready for when it hits the fan. And guys like you are on here to tell the truth. And like I've heard you say before, we will win because we have the truth on our side.
We have the truth on our side. That's exactly right. That's why they fear us, is because we have the truth on our side. But I'm not doing this to scare people. I'm doing it to just try to help and try to reduce a little bit of the coming misery.
Exactly.
Thanks a lot. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for spreading the truth. I'll speak to you again sometime soon. Thank you so much, Whit.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, the mighty PK will soon sign off. But before that, I'd like to thank BBS Radio for promoting free speech and for having me on. And we will see you again, or let's tune in again next week, same time, same place. This is PK signing out from Third Stream View. Have a good one, everybody. See you later.